Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. For more information and to donate online, go to 3cr.org.au. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
It's time to talk about decolonising Australia. Join me, Rima Ratan, as I ask First Nations Australians about how they are decolonising and what settlers can do to help. Decolonising Australia, Monday nights at 6 p.m. on 3CR. Hello, I'm Rima Ratan. Welcome to the final episode of Decolonising Australia, a 2019-2020 summer special on 3CR. Over the last several weeks, we've heard from Thomas Mayer about the Uluru Statement, Museum of Contemporary Art curator Clotilde Bullen and artist Megan Cope about their unique approaches to their work, and lawyer Tila Reid about decolonising the law. My guest today is public health researcher Dr. Chelsea Bond. This interview was recorded at the very start of the year, and I've been struggling to edit our conversation down to fit what time we have here. So many thanks to Dr. Bond for her patience, and let's dive straight in.
My name is Dr. Chelsea Bond. I'm a Mulunjali and South Sea Islander woman born and raised on Yuggera country. I'm an associate professor at the University of Queensland School of Social Science.
Your work has mainly been in public health, is that correct?
Yes, so my undergrad and postgraduate training was in public health, so I'm very much, I think, at the margins of my discipline. I'm not a traditional public health professional, I would argue.
In what way?
So I'm not an epidemiologist, firstly. I think that if you're not an epidemiologist in public health, it can be difficult to find your place. And the things that interest me, I'm less interested in describing ill health. I'm less interested in interrogating black bodies to understand why we die at least 10 years earlier, and more interested in the systems and structures that make it so. And I think that even now, I think public health, much work is still to be done to change the gaze away from black lack to explain health inequality.
That's an interesting phrase you used, black lack. Couldn't you explain that for our reader, listeners?
So typically, I think, you know, when I was trained in Indigenous health, we were to look at the bodies and behaviours of black people. And we presume that black people either don't care about our health or we just don't know what's good for us. And that's why we die earlier. And so there's so much energy invested in teaching black people how to live healthier, make better choices, as if there are unlimited choices available to black people in this place, to somehow live longer. Public health is almost silent about the violence that black bodies encounter every day in this place, particularly when it comes to understanding race and racism. So I was trained, for instance, how to take blood pressures and blood sugar levels. I wasn't given a vocabulary for understanding how race operates in this place.
The health system is responsible for quite a lot of death among First Nation people, often through, can blatantly be called racism, people being sent home without adequate care and all that sort of thing. What does it take to shift the focus of public health when surely there's plenty of evidence now?
I think all systems and institutions in the colony are responsible for the deaths of black people. I think we've been under some sort of delusion that public health and health service and health system are benevolent and caring places that aren't complicit in that same violence. And part of my work is actually showing that, and it comes from my experiences as a black woman accessing health services, as a health researcher working in health and looking at the way in which racialized knowledge gets reproduced under, you know, so-called benevolent endeavors such as Close the Gap. So I think for me, some of my work is actually contesting the claims that the health system is not complicit in the deaths of black people. I don't think we've got to that point yet. And we presume that the health system is race blind, colour blind, when we in fact know that's not the case. It never has been the case here. So I think we have to be, for me it's about being honest about health's role in the production of ill health, but health is one system of many that is involved in the production of ill health and premature death of black fellows in this place.
So this show is about decolonising. Would you consider what you're trying to achieve in public health as a decolonising practice?
I struggle with the term decolonising. I don't know what that is, so long as the settlers are still here. I'm interested in health justice, in being treated fairly and appropriately. I'm not sure that's decolonising. I think that's just how we should be treated. I think yes. The decolonising agenda is, I'm reluctant to call it that because I don't know what that that is, well, so long as the settlers are here.
Well, you spoke of racialized knowledge within public health. How do we change that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there is a really strong resistance against that. You know, I am trained in public health, but I've never had an academic appointment within a school of public health. And I don't even sit in health anymore. I sit in the social sciences. So I think you'll find those of us who are engaged in the work often are put at the very margins. And there is a fierce resistance and a need to protect health and its claims of benevolence. But to be honest, I'm not sure how we change that. I don't believe that somehow we'll get to the mountaintop and, you know, transcend race, and that there'll ever be a day where there won't be the production of racialized knowledges in this place. That doesn't mean I'm not still committed to doing work that seeks to undermine its impact. And I guess it's why I'm interested in health justice, is for those, what Du Bois calls those blue sky moments, those wins that you can get, that you can claw back to restore a sense of humanity to our people in our country that we became human in. And so for me, it's about getting what we can for our mob in the course of this work, accepting the reality that the settlers are always going to be violent, as are their institutions.
It's interesting that you identify what you do as being on the margins of public health, when it sounds like what you're doing is a cutting-edge idea. You're embracing the social determinants of health. How do you end up on the margins when you're doing what you're doing is avant-garde?
If we take the claim that public health is committed to the health of all people, then it would seem absurd. But I don't think public health in this place has ever been committed to the health of all people, particularly not black people. And in fact, much of the violence that's been perpetrated against black people in this place has been via a discourse of health advancement or health care. So health has always been violent for black fellas. If we look at public health, it has a very violent history in this place for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and the way in which, you know, we were seen as a threat to the health of the general population. So there's been a long, you know, we were constructed as a dying race.
Yes.
For so long. So where was public health in all of this? So in public health, I speak of myself as a genocide survivor, but you won't hear that talk in Indigenous health. We hear close the gap and health choices and health behaviours. We're still subscribing to the idea that black people just need to make better choices because everyone else apparently is committed to us living long and prosperous lives. And this is the thing, I think, you know, if you look at the history of public health in this place, the way in which black bodies were framed as a threat to the general population in public health to justify us being locked away on missions and reserves and not being able to move into towns and that kind of stuff. The way in which, you know, we were listed as a source of contamination for STIs in Queensland government reporting, for instance. I don't know when that stopped in health. I don't know when health or any other institution in this place ever got to its post-colonial moment. And I'm bummed I've missed out on the party. What was the time in our history that all of that stuff stopped? When did the colony stop being a colony? When did it stop being so violent? I just don't know, like, when the year, when the date was. I mean, even people will refer to the, you know, 67 referendum as, you know, a turning point. But the only reason that yes vote got up really was because the world was watching and Australia was embarrassed on the international stage at a time when there was global social change happening. So we didn't want to look as bad as, you know, look bad on the international stage. That wasn't because white fellas here suddenly decided they cared about black people. That's the thing I get confused by when, you know, when we talk about decolonising, what's to suggest that there is an appetite for a decolonising agenda in this place, like a genuine decolonising agenda that involves, like, I don't know, land and the return of land to black people or power? I'm not here for a decolonising agenda that's all about making, you know, services that should be accessible to everyone, accessible to people. That's not decolonising, that's just getting to what we should have gotten in the first place.
Yeah, that's a social equality, right?
Yeah, and that's everyone should have. Everyone should be, treated fairly and justly when they're accessing school and educational institutions and health services and all those kinds of things. We're still fighting, for instance, in this day and age, we're still fighting to get examined appropriately when we present at emergency wards in our hospitals. And that is a death sentence for Aboriginal women in this country right now. Black women are telling a story right now in death of the violence of this place, whether it's in hospitals, whether it's in watch houses. This place has not relinquished its violence. So I find it hard to speak about decolonising. We're still on the frontier, and it's really violent for those of us still working on the frontier.
From what other people I've spoken to are saying, and you know, it's a process. There's no end point, it seems to me, like you just keep trying, especially, as you say, if the settlers are still here, there's no decolonisation. It's just making the colony more comfortable.
Absolutely, the settlers feel more at home in this place that they stole. And, you know, when you go to other countries and other black nations, where land is still passed down through ceremony, and you come back here and realise what has been taken from us, improving service delivery for, you know, things that are essentially our right, to me cannot be framed as decolonisation.
No, and it because it's so basic, right?
It's so basic. But this is how bad this place is, how out of control the settlers are, in that we are made to believe that the few crumbs we get is progressive, transformative, emancipatory. And it's not. When I tell the truth about that stuff, it's not because I'm being pessimistic. I'm just telling a truth. And yet, if you're a truth teller and a black fella in this place, it's really violent.
Well, also, you're a crazy black woman.
Crazy black woman, you get defamation threats at your workplace. You get marginalised in your discipline, you get marginalised in your institution. Despite that, I think the most exciting work that black fellas can do is at the margins. I think it's the most courageous work to do work that isn't popular, to shift from the boundaries. I think if you're in the centre, in the middle, it's really hard to shift the boundaries.
And also you're embedded in the power structures that put you in the centre, right?
Yeah, and that's not to suggest that, I mean, we need mob working everywhere in this place and working together in that kind of the work. But I think the one comfort that black fellas can get in working at the margins is the knowledge that that's a place in where some shifts can be made, although, albeit unpopular, albeit not necessarily the best career move, albeit the burden that you then take home to your kitchen table with your family, there is necessary work to be done in working at the boundaries and being of service to other black fellas. If I was to think about decolonisation divorced of land, at the very least, it's being of service to black people and black agendas. And so that means making a choice of who you're here to serve. Is it about accessorising white institutions to make them look progressive and woke, or is it about transforming and undermining the power those institutions have and redistributing power to those who've been long denied it?
But universities are deeply conservative. How do you be radical in a university in Australia in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I wouldn't frame myself as radical. I'd say I'm truthful. I know the violence of the knowledges that's produced in places like this. And so I'm under no illusion that I work in a progressive institution. My husband was a police officer for 15 years trying to be a better black copper on the street in his community than the violent ones that he encountered and I encountered in the course of our lifetime. And I got to see the violence that he experienced in that place, and I can tell you that the police service is no different to academic institutions. One just has a more sophisticated articulation of its racism. So I'm not here of service to the institution in propping up the knowledge, and I'm not under any illusion that this institution is violent to me on any given day.
Would you see it as a means to an end? You're there because that's where you can do something, but
I'm not. Look, I think I can do some things here, but, you know, each year you get the same intake of the same students saying the same things and going the same journey and then graduating and then returning to the default mode that is how it is to be in the colony. So I'm not convinced that the work I do here is necessarily transformative here. I'm interested in the things that I can take from places like this and do work outside of this place, in as much as the work that I can do in this place. It's funny, one of the most, what would appear the most trivial things that I did when I first had an academic title at a university was to be a character reference for a black fella trying to get bail when he went to court. And to be able to use an institutional affiliation and a title to credentialise a character reference for a black fella that's been demonised through much of his life and to get bail is a useful thing to do. Not to say that I just did a PhD so I could write good character references, but it's thinking about how do we use positions of power in order to be able to undermine how power operates, but how do we learn about how power operates in places like this? And so there are some useful things in academic institutions, but for me, I'm here to work at, well, what are the useful things here that can be of use to MOB?
An eclectic sort of hunting out tools from colonial institutions even to help people.
Two questions that really bother me in this place. What does justice feel like and what does it mean to be free? And professionally, there is this tiny bit of freedom that comes with being an academic in terms of this concept of academic freedom, is that I get to say and do things that I wouldn't be able to do in other jobs. So there is a practical function of operating in this space. And I never want to take for granted those bits of freedom that I get to have. I mean, I don't get to be as free as the white scholar who's not talking about race. You know, I still have to think about asset protection and lawsuit and crazy threats of violence and dealing with members of the public who feel that they're entitled to come for you. So it's not like I'm free in, you know, absolute terms, but I get to decide where I exhaust my labour on some days. And that's a privilege that my mother-in-law, my grandmother, and those that have gone before them just didn't have. So I don't want to, and when I speak about the violence of places like this, I don't want to acknowledge the privileges that I gain from being in places like this and how those titles can work, at least in part, at some times.
Yalakut Willamnagi, Australia's First Nations Festival, returns Saturday, February 1st with soulful live music and free family entertainment. Get your funk on to Emma Donovan and the Putbacks, plus Coloured Stone, Kian, the Struggling Kings, Kihu, and loads more music from the finest First Nations artists in Australia. Eat and browse your way through market stalls or get hands-on at the many workshops and activities on offer. Yalakut Willamnagi proudly celebrates Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures across one day where everyone is welcome. Head to ywnf.com.au for details. City of Port Phillip and Yalakut Willamnagi, 3CR supporters.
You're listening to Decolonising Australia on 3CR, and this is the final show for the short series, which has been part of our special summer programming. This is an interview I recorded with public health researcher Dr. Chelsea Bond in early January. What can settler Australians do apart from, you know, go back?
Be as committed to the emancipation of black people as they are to exploiting black people's land. And I don't know how you separate the two, but I think about being prepared to do the work and pay the cost. Every day, blackfellas pay a cost for living in this place. Every day, a trade-off, a navigation of, you know, when you're not supposed to be in a place, you get reminded that every day. It's not just not seeing yourself on television. It's being told to move on. It's being locked up. It's being erased from the curriculum when you're sitting in an exam and you're a second-year nutrition student and you're asked to imagine what it is to be a non-Indigenous health professional. It's the everydayness of dispossession, and black bodies are paying a price for that. What are white people and non-white settlers prepared to relinquish in the course of that?
We need to have better eyes and the truth-telling things, like to actually see Australia as it was before it was Australia, as it was lived in by its First Nations people.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, at a very basic level, like, actually recognise our existence. This country is founded upon our non-existence, and it still gets reproduced. I mean, even in the dreadful, it was a Jeremy Clarkson op-ed piece, that people weren't actually horrified at the fact that he completely erased Indigenous existence in that nonsense. And so, like, every day we have to encounter people who claim that we're not here. It's like we're like the Loch Ness Monster or something. You know, at protests you can see signs that say, still here. Blackfellas are singing songs called Still Here. Yeah. Like, we are still in 2020 saying, we are still here. Now, if your existence in a place is predicated upon not seeing us, then you're not a good ally. And to undo that not seeing means to be critically conscious in every moment, where are the black fellas at the table? Where are black voices? Where is black thought? That's the one thing I love doing in places like this, is to render visible black thought, because we've been denied not just our existence, but our ability to be knowers of our own existence. And so I enjoy being still here in this place, asserting the truth about our presence in this place to the anthropologists who've long maintained the monopoly over knowing us, to the health researcher who've long maintained monopoly over saving us, And so I think for all settlers, it's undoing this idea that we don't exist.
There's so little in the education system.
We go to the same schools, we watch the same TV, the same news. Yep. And so the violence of dispossession upon black minds is a thing where, you know, every day we're told that we're not here, and if we are here, we're not really here because we're not really real. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's really hard. It's been really hard for black fellas in this place going to school, being told that we were hunters and gatherers that went walkabout and lived in humpies. And then suddenly all of these white guys came and settled the place, and all is well with the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, black fellas have to do that work too, and we've been doing it. And living with the trauma, though, of what happens at the table in our classroom and the table in our kitchen, and the very different stories that get told.
To forget the school curriculum, there's plenty of knowledge out there if you choose to look for it.
There is more. I think there's still more work to be done, and more work of black fellas telling our stories and our history, because it's still a lot of the knowledge that is out there now is still not told by us and not all correct. You know, I think what people will find, there may be greater access to a kind of universal Aboriginal history.
Yes, there is.
But try and find your local history, the place that you live in, the street that you live on. It's always, we've seen this emergence of a kind of a generic Aboriginal history, a generic Aboriginal culture. But we were a continent of many, many nations, and to find nation-specific information is not so easy. So there's still, I think, a long way to go in terms of telling the stories of our own country that are specific and unique to the country that we're on. And so for me, Indigenous knowledges that are divorced from the land in which it comes from still remains limited.
Maybe if settlers learned local Indigenous languages where they live, it would actually, language shifts the way you see the world. And maybe we can see the world better.
I mean, I think even in the city of Brisbane or Mianjin, there are people who every day are speaking an Aboriginal language but just have no idea. So suburbs of Indooroopilly, for instance, language is still present. People just aren't aware of their relationship to that language. And I guess it's thinking about not what can be taken up or taken, but how does it then bring one into relationship with the place? And so I think we have any number of non-Indigenous people who can go to, you know, a remote part of this country and learn an Aboriginal language and even get a skin name. It doesn't make them any less colonising. So there is a danger, I think, in conversations about culture and cultural revitalisation, is that it's another place in which we are claimed and those power relationships get reproduced, in which, if you think about it, even historically, there were, you know, any number of settlers who had Aboriginal artefacts and, in fact, Aboriginal body parts in their lounge room.
Didn't make them kinder to Indigenous people.
The relationship wasn't there. So there's, I think, sometimes the taking up of Aboriginal things without being in proper relationship with Aboriginal people, there's a violence attached to that. We know from our history.
This idea that what settlers can do is have real relationships with Indigenous people. You also don't want, like, a bunch of people going, be my friend now, right? You don't want some sort of token friendship thing
exploding.
Oh,
no, but by saying real relationships, it's about going, well, okay, maybe we can accept that black people can lead stuff and be in leadership positions. Maybe we don't need to govern and manage black people. So when I think about relationships, I'm talking about relationships of power, not just becoming acquainted with and sampling someone's food or their culture, but actually going, well, how is power operating here and how do we change that? And being committed to changing those relationships of power, even if it's not of your own, to your own benefit. And especially that. And so I think about the work of Aunty Lilla Watson and Aunty Mary Graham, who talk about Indigenous terms of reference and talk about the need to behave relationally. And what does a non-colonising coexistence look like? I don't think decolonisation is the work of black people, it's the work of the settlers. And perhaps it's not decolonising, but what does it mean to have a non-colonising coexistence? What does it mean to come to a place and not take it over, to not erase, not have your existence predicated upon someone else's non-existence? I mean, how do we get to that point? Because we haven't relinquished that idea. And so unless the settlers are prepared to relinquish the idea that we're not here, unless they can find some sort of way to exist in this place that's not predicated upon taking from us or erasing us, then we can't have decolonisation in any kind of form. And I'm not convinced that the settlers can do that. both the old and the new will want to do that. I mean, power's never ceded, so no one's giving up anything. And I guess that's what interests me as an Indigenous scholar, is actually learning from Indigenous resistance, Indigenous activism, to think about how to be in this place. And I think if you want to learn about survival, and, you know, this country's had to deal with how to survive in this climate right now, so tragically, the one people you turn to would be those that have been here for like 60,000 years, you would think. Even those that have survived genocide have something to teach about survival in this place. And I'm not sure that the settlers here are ready to learn from us. And I say that as someone who's taught in higher ed for some time. Very few people want to learn from me. They want to accessorize themselves with me or my culture, but they really struggle with seeing me as a knower. The one thing I want to say is, for black fellas, is we have to remember who this work is for. Who are we turning up to each day for? And how are we using the little bits of power that we do have on any given day to redistribute it, not reproduce those relationships? And so the exciting part for me is the work that I get to do with and for other black fellas. In ways that affirm, that restore our sense of self, our sense of dignity, our humanity, even in our laughter. That's the work that gives me joy and sustains me. And, yeah, I think that too long, you know, we've been forced in a role of service to the settlers for generations. And so the question for us as blackfellas is, what does it mean to serve each other, to serve ourselves, regardless of how white institutions and white people think of us? And that is a real challenge, but an exciting one.
You've been listening to Decolonising Australia on 3CR, and that was Dr. Chelsea Bond talking to me about public health. We're back to regular programming from next Monday, when Communication Mixdown will be back at this time. Next up is Eritrean Voices, but meanwhile, let's go out with a song chosen by Chelsea. This is Thelma Plum with Better in Black.